We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This year, our program turns 30, and we're marking the anniversary by bringing back some programs that predate our existing archive and so haven't been heard for many years. And we went looking for topics that seem to be as important today as they were when we first had these conversations. In part one of the show, in this hour, you'll hear edited portions of an interview that I did in 1996 with Andrew Young. He's been a member of Congress, mayor of Atlanta, and also served as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. We talked about his life, his involvement in the civil rights movement, and his relationship with Martin Luther King, all subjects that he wrote about in his memoir, An Easy Burden, The Civil Rights Movement and the Transformation of America. We began by talking about his childhood in New Orleans.
New Orleans, where I lived, was not a city with a great deal of racial tension. There was a legal segregation, though, and it was something my parents had to explain to me. Also, right on the corner of my house was the German-American Bund. And as a young boy, because there was no air conditioning and the windows were always open, walking past there on weekends, I'd see people, you know, with swastikas and Heil Hitler. So it was a funny kind of community, but it was a community that my parents prepared me for. And they explained to me what was going on. They helped me to try to understand racism, not to get bitter about it, but to realize it was something, it was a burden that I had to bear. But it was an easy burden if I took it on every day of my life.
How did they explain that to you?
Well, they said basically that, you know, Nazis were sick people, that racists were people who didn't have an opportunity to get much education, and they blamed their own problems on blacks. And that made sense, even at 4 years old, still does. But they also went on to say, you don't get mad at people for being sick or being ignorant. You help them. And when you get angry with somebody, you, particularly if there's a conflict or struggle, you're more likely to lose because you get emotional instead of using your head.
What is it that gives people, you think, the strength to be able to take that kind of attitude? It always surprises me and impresses me that someone could live under those sort of circumstances and rather than being consumed with rage would take that kind of an attitude.
I think it's the love of family, and it was sort of the teaching of my church. That you really have to help people. You don't want to destroy your enemies. And I guess I grew up in a community where, in a church where love of enemies was quite acceptable. Now they would say you love the hell out of them, and you accept the fact that people are filled with a lot of hell, But there are lots of reasons, and I was fortunate in that I had both mother and father and grandparents and aunts and uncles, and I was in a loving community all of my young life. And that gave me the strength. But then there were people who didn't have that kind of support and who didn't have, you know, the kind of education my parents had behind them.
Your father was a dentist.
That's right.
And when you were getting ready to go to college, a lot of folks expected, and I think actually your mother and father expected, that you would follow him into that profession. And were disappointed?
Well, they were.
That you didn't.
They were, and I talk about that in the book, and I talk about it in some detail, because I think almost every parent has expectations for their children. And the children may not have the same, you know, hopes and aspirations. And that's usually a kind of, well, it was the one source of conflict in my family. My daddy wanted me to play baseball and wanted me to be a dentist. And baseball is probably the only sport I never really played. It wasn't because I didn't love my daddy. It was because we played basketball in New Orleans, and we played football. We didn't play much baseball. He grew up in the country, but he never understood that. He just thought I'd make a great baseball player, and I'd make a great dentist. And even when I was sworn in as ambassador to the United Nations and President Carter said, well, I know you're proud of your son, his answer was, well, if, and it was jokingly, but he said, well, if he'd have been a dentist, he'd have really been somebody.
How, can you talk about how it is that you felt called to become a minister?
Well, I tell you, I had this very, I think, privileged upbringing. And one of the stories I tell in the book is, you know, being a lifeguard in the swimming pool just before my senior year in college. And a guy came in and almost drowned. And when we pulled him out, I realized he was a drug addict. But I knew him. And he finally reminded me that we had been put out of school together in third grade for playing with an ice pick in the back of the room. And you had to bring your parents back. Well, my parents came back with me and got me back in school the next day. In fact, I think it might have been even been the same day. But his parents never came back, and he never set foot in school after third grade. And he was in and out of jail and had lived a very rough street life. But he sat there lecturing me on why it was important for me to get my education. And at that time, I was in college thinking that college was mainly for girls and sports and, you know, fraternities. And he talked about how people like him needed somebody to help, you know, change the world so that they could have a better chance. Well, it was clear to me that he had as much intelligence, if not more, than I had. But I had been given the blessing of having, you know, father and mother. His mother was a domestic worker in New Orleans. In those days, domestic workers made only a dollar a day, and she couldn't take off to come see about him. And I had to say, there but for the grace of God go I. And I think that started me thinking my last year. What, you know, and my mother and grandmother used to quote the Bible to me all the time, saying, to them to whom much has been given, of them will much be required. And I knew I had been given a lot. And I didn't know how, what was required of me. And I think that led me to raising spiritual questions, which ultimately led me into the ministry and into my work with Martin Luther King.
When did you first meet Dr. King?
Well, I was a young minister in Georgia. He was in Montgomery, Alabama, and the bus boycott started in December. And that spring, in March of 1956, we were both invited to speak at a little church-related college, Talladega College in Alabama. And we were on the same program. He spoke in the morning. We were on the program in the afternoon, and then I spoke in the evening. And my wife and Coretta grew up in the same little town in Alabama, so they knew each other. They invited us to stop by on the way back to Thomasville, which is where I was, when we drove through Montgomery. And we stopped by the house and talked a bit. But, you know, I say then I wanted to talk about politics and theology. He was just thrilled with his new baby girl. And he just wanted to you know, do daddy talk.
For a lot of people, he is someone that we see in old newsreel footage, and is you know, probably up there with other Americans who have played an important role of history, and yet they're part of this sort of fuzzy past that now many people, younger people, don't have any personal connection to.
And I, you know, I really I grew up in the 30s, and I heard generally about Roosevelt and, you know, knew from a distance what was going on. But, say, reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book on No Ordinary Time, the Roosevelt, Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt biography, it brought back things that were sort of that I'd heard, but I didn't really understand in detail. I've tried to do that for the 60s. People who were growing up or who were grown and who thought about the 60s only as they saw it in the newspaper, I've tried to make it human. And there have been a lot of books written on the 60s and on Martin Luther King, but even the best ones were written, well, Taylor Branch's books. Taylor Branch was a 16-year-old in an Atlanta public high school when Martin was doing all this. I was sort of with him in the room and kind of tell about the human side.
Well, what kind of a person was he?
Well, that was the thing that people completely miss is he had a tremendous sense of humor. I've always said that the person who I thought would play the best Martin Luther King amongst actors would be Eddie Murphy. Because Martin had that same kind of personality in private. I mean, he was constantly joking. He did sort of impressions of different preachers and mimicked you in various ways. And he was a lot of fun. He was a good athlete, you know, and kids see him as a saint and a prophet, but they can't imagine him on a basketball court. Even though he was very small, he was good and could shoot with both hands. And he was in every respect a young man who grew up in a very privileged family. I mean, his father was a minister, his grandfather was a minister, his father was one of the founders of the bank in Atlanta, the first black bank in the South. So he came from a very successful background. And yet he grew up in the YMCA and was active in the church was not really an exceptional student, was a good student, but not an exceptional student at Morehouse College. But he was sensitive to what God was doing in the world and in his life, and he made it his business to be in the right place at the right time.
If the black church had not been the kind of institution that it was, do you think that the civil rights movement as we knew it could have occurred?
It would have been very difficult because anybody that talked about social change in a secular context, was considered a communist. He talked about social change in a biblical context. And that made it acceptable both to black people, who were not communists, but who could understand a religious rationale for freedom. And also it made it more acceptable to the white community that this was, even though they disagreed with it, the fact that there was a religious motivation and intention around this movement meant that they had to take another look at it. They couldn't completely dismiss it.
Hmm. When people think about this time and they think about people who were very, very important leaders in the black community, people who were on a national level, two names that are always going to come to mind are Martin Luther King and also Malcolm X.
Uh-huh.
And people talk about them almost as being polar opposites in their approach. And some people perhaps have been critical of Dr. King for being too accommodating and have looked to, you know, have appreciated Malcolm X because he was so fierce and so uncompromising and really in the face of white society. And perhaps there were arguments, I'm sure there were arguments at the time about the merits of those two approaches and which might be more successful. And I wonder now, as you think about the character and the personality of these two men, if you have some sort of thought about, were they indeed so different?
Well,
were they in
they
some
were,
ways
they
alike?
Were not, they were not so different. Their difference was in their upbringing. Martin's family was very successful, even wealthy by black standards. Martin was assured a college education and a guarantee of graduate school. Malcolm did not have that assurance, and he did not get that formal training. Martin Luther King actually earned a Ph.D. degree in philosophy from Boston University. Malcolm was more like the bright young men of today who get angry and they're exposed in the street and they're much more likely to end up in jail than they are in college. But I would say that both of them had, that if Malcolm had had the same opportunities that Martin had educationally, he could have earned a Ph.D. also. I think that it took Malcolm longer to get a sense of direction about. He was very strong in his rhetoric about black people developing a sense of pride, but he was talking to black people in the North that didn't have a sense of pride. Martin Luther King's family owned a bank. He was pastor of a 3,000-member church. There was pride in his community, and he didn't have to talk about pride. We took that for granted. He'd gone to an all-black college where they had a sense of race pride automatically instilled, even in a time of segregation. And so they were just completely different.
You were there when Dr. King was killed?
Yes, I was. Mm-hmm. It was, well, it was a spring day in Memphis. And I had been in the courthouse all day. And he'd been sick the night before, so he'd stayed there at the hotel. But when I came back, he was feeling good and very playful. One of the, I think, most fun scenes with him occurred just before he was killed, because when I came in and he hadn't heard from me all day long, he said, "Why didn't you call?" And I said, "I was in the courtroom." And he said, "You ought to find a way to leave and let me know what's going on." And I said, "Well, you know, you feeling good enough, you should have been down there yourself." And he threw a pillow at me. And I threw it back. Then everybody picked up pillows and beat me over the head with them and, you know, down in the between the two beds. And it was really a very playful moment. Then when we came to our senses, he said, "Well, look, we're supposed to go out to dinner. Let me go change shirts." So he left and went to his hotel room, which was just upstairs in an open courtyard, and we went out into the courtyard to wait for him to come out. And when he came out, he didn't have on a top coat, and we said, "You know, you better bring your top coat because it's cool in the evenings, and you're just getting over, you know, cold." And he said, "Oh, I don't know whether I need a coat or not." And next thing I knew, a shot rang out. We thought it was a firecracker or a car backfiring. But as soon as we ran to the top of the steps and saw that he'd been shot and that the shot had severed his spinal cord and that he probably didn't even hear the bullet or feel the bullet.
I think sometimes when somebody who was really close to you dies, that it's very difficult to accept the fact that they're gone. And somehow, you know, many times you feel like you should be able to look up and see that person come through the door. Was there a time when somehow it finally hit you that indeed he was dead and
he
was gone?
In a way, he prepared us and his children and family constantly for his death. He had been stabbed in Harlem in the late 50s while he was signing copies of his book by a demented woman. And he used to say that, "You know, you all say you're ready to die, but you don't know what it's like. I've been there." And then he'd tell in a joking way about his experience of being stabbed. And instead of talking about himself being killed, he would say, you know, some of you all are not going to make it to the promised land. And then he'd joke with us about the kind of funeral he'd preach, you know, if one of us got killed. So it was as though it was a daily ritual to talk about death. And so much so that we just didn't believe it was real when it happened. But we were prepared, and we knew we had to go on and carry on his work as best we could. It was difficult with him. It seemed at that time that was almost going to be impossible without him. But we've managed to make it, and I think on race relations and war, I think we've made significant progress. It's only in dealing with poverty, which also has some serious racial implications. But poverty is a crisis in America for blacks and whites. And I would say that that's the part of his work that we still have to take on in the 21st century.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, someone in Champaign, and we will do that right now. Line number one.
Hello, yes.
Yeah.
Hello. A question. Yes. Mm-hmm. Hello?
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Black leadership in the past was prepared to death, according to what you were saying. And I guess my question focuses around the courage of today's leadership facing the issues of poverty, not racism, which the civil rights movement has addressed and I think has addressed properly.
Mm-hmm.
But my criticism is, where is black leadership now?
Well, I don't know. Where are you?
Well, where's black leadership now in
where
terms
are
of
you?
Courage?
Where are you? Let me just say, I don't know how old you are, but Martin Luther King was 25. I was about 22 when we started. Nobody considered us leaders. We got to be leaders because we had the courage to take on the problems. But nobody gave us any credentials, or nobody elected us or appointed us to anything. We just ended up in the forefront of something because of our consciences. And I think that there are lots of young people out there now, and I think that the difference is that we had, through the NAACP and Urban League, we had a consensus that racism and segregation had to go, and the best way to change it was to change the laws. There really is no consensus, and because we agreed on that, we were ready to live or die for that. I don't know specifically, see, are you ready to die to increase the minimum wage a dollar? Or are you ready to die for, I mean, how do we end poverty? And I think when we get a consensus on the best approach to end poverty, I think people will make a commitment to some of the things that they think will work. And if that means losing jobs or giving their lives, I think there's just as much courage now as there ever was. I think we just don't have a clear sense of direction. And one of the reasons why I tried to write about the methodology of how we got together and changed things in the 60s and 70s was because I think that people like you, if you understood clearly what we did, you would be better informed about what you ought to do in whatever problems you face in today's world, leading us into the 21st century.
And that is Andrew Young speaking on Focus in November of 1996. His memoir is An Easy Burden, The Civil Rights Movement and the Transformation of America. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. We're celebrating the 30th anniversary of the show by digging into what we're calling the Deep Archives, bringing back shows that haven't been heard in many years. And that means that in this hour, we're not taking calls. Of course, you can tell us what you think about this or any other show we broadcast by going to our website. That's will.illinois.edu. In part two of the show, we have an interview from 2000 with Randall Robinson, founder of Trans Africa, a nonprofit that he started in the mid-70s to promote awareness of Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. He was also very involved in the movement against apartheid. in South Africa. He's the author of several books, including The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, and in that book he argued for reparations for African Americans still suffering from generations of discrimination. He began our conversation by explaining that if we want to understand the present, we must first understand the past.
If we only looked at this time any indication of what is as a suggestion that it has always been, we would be seriously misled. But part of the problem we have in our society is that we don't have much sense of long-term history. What happened? Blacks are behind. We either are behind because we are innately inferior, and the science suggests that that is ludicrous, or something happened. We live in a culture of some significant sustained denial, a culture, a political culture that doesn't want to revisit any past, to look at any conditions that produced this disparity that we see in the world. And so while our country has encouraged, insisted, in fact, that other societies that have committed great wrongs against peoples of their own, largely, that insisted that they atone and compensate, we've been disinclined to do that in our own society. We've just finished urging Germany, 16 German corporations, to come to terms with Jews injured and killed and abused and enslaved during the Nazi Holocaust. That was led by Stuart Eisenstadt at the behest of the president with support of both houses of Congress. The corporation settled for in excess of $5.5 billion, and that should have been the case. A wrong was committed. It had to be compensated. It had to be recognized, and it had to be addressed. We've said as much to Serbia. We've said it to Rwandans. We've said it to Burundians. We've said it to Australians. We've said it to anybody in the world who's committed wrongs against sections of their own populations. But with the case of Africans in the world and African Americans, America is disinclined to even acknowledge responsibility for a wrong, much less prepare to compensate for that wrong. And it has left this absence of memory. It has left the victims to conclude that they're in this fix because there is something innately wrong with them, when in fact we're talking here about the longest running human rights crime in the world over the last 500 years, 246 years of slavery, followed by a century of de jure discrimination. And so all of this long enterprise of exploration, has occurred in the United States with the full complicity of a government that benefited from this exploitation.
Something that I think perhaps a lot of people will puzzle over and perhaps not understand or even know how to think about is just what has happened in the last 100 years since the end of slavery. And I think people...
First of all, you had coming into the... After slavery, of all, there was no compensation, not even apology. Lincoln supported compensation to the slave owners, not to the slaves. 40 acres and a mule were voted by the House and the Senate, but it was vetoed by President Andrew Johnson, who had himself owned slaves. Of course, towards the 20th century and into the 20th century, freed slaves, illiterate, without prospect, penniless, and jobless, were left to fend for themselves and facing new discrimination in the Old South. There were black codes and peonage laws. Peonage laws meant in the 1920s that any black arrested for vagrancy in the South could be purchased out of prison by the plantation owner, and put to work on that plantation, just as the father and mother of that vagrant had been working on that plantation as slaves. As a matter of fact, the lot of the vagrant may have been worse because he or she had less value to the plantation owner. He or she was not property of the plantation owner, and if the vagrant died, the plantation owner would simply go back to the plantation and get another slave. The state of Georgia had built no classrooms 50 years after slavery, blacks still going to school in back sheds and rooms in churches. The state of Georgia didn't allow blacks to even take academic courses in the 8th and 9th grade for fear that they might somehow, by hook or crook, finish high school. The plantation sharecropping system was still in place 85 years after slavery. And, of course, we all know about the 47 or so hundred lynchings in the United States and the 90 or so riots that took place, Tulsa being the best known now. But all of these things claim many lives and, of course, segregation. We had, from 1929 to 1969, Berkeley, a study done at Berkeley documents that the losses to the black community because of wage discrimination, job discrimination, would amount to $1.6 trillion because of restrictive covenants that were in housing contracts blessed by the Federal Housing Authority until 1950, until I was 9 years old, prohibited blacks from buying homes. That was succeeded, of course, by redlining and general mortgage discrimination. It is estimated that in mortgage discrimination alone, lost in home equity, wealth to blacks, and home equity, of course, is the largest wealth-building tool for middle-class Americans. Lost opportunities to blacks would sum up to some $80 to $90 billion per generation. And because of all of this, you see, blacks can't be said to have accomplished full citizenship in the United States until 1965 with the passing of the Voting Rights Act. Because of all of this government-embraced discrimination in the United States, this gap that was opened during slavery was sustained through the 20th century. And it's important to remember that the wealth that was amassed in America, making this a powerful global power during the centuries of slavery, was wealth that enriched the federal treasury, made rich entrepreneurs north and south, but it was wealth that was produced by people who were never paid. Cotton was our leading export throughout the years of slavery. It produced more in foreign exchange than all other exports put together. Everybody got rich. The slave builders, the slave ship builders got rich. The people who outfitted the ships, the cork makers, the rope makers, the federal treasury, everybody got rich but the people who produced the cotton.
Our guest, I should reintroduce. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Randall Robinson. He is founder and president of TransAfrica, an organization that has done a lot to try to influence U.S. policies toward Africa and the Caribbean. Personally, he was very involved in the anti-apartheid movement, also in the restoration of democracy in Haiti. He is the author of the book Defending the Spirit, which is a memoir, autobiography, and also of a recently published book that explores the ideas we're talking about here this morning. That book is titled The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, and it's published by Dutton. The phone lines are certainly open here. If you have comments, questions, you can call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana locally, where we are, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've read your book, Mr. Robinson, and I read both. I've read your autobiography, and I read the recent book on the debt. I am an academic. I'm a legal academic here at the U of I, African American, and in law and in legal academics because of the belief that lawyers wield an inordinate amount of power in this country, rightly or wrongly, in shaping public policy. I am very disturbed, very disheartened about the atmosphere that exists here at the U of I College of Law in terms of total ignorance of the plight of African Americans throughout the history of this country, not only among whites who do have white supremacy, but also among younger African Americans who don't seem to understand their roots historically and how they must be at the vanguard of making sure that reparations do become a reality, if that's politically possible here. My question to you is, how do you account for even the grudging willingness for whites to even admit wrong in slavery? Because I remember President Clinton sort of gave a lukewarm, tepid apology when he went to Africa, and that created all kinds of outcry here. Much less, how do you account for African Americans being treated differently than, say, groups like the Japanese, who were given some reparations for being interned during World War II? I believe in some instances Native Americans have been given some reparations, and of course the recent reparations bestowed upon people of Jewish ethnicity. Why does it seem like it's fashionable to despise blacks at the expense of all other racial and ethnic groups in this country?
Well, let me start with that. I think what distinguishes this crime against humanity, its breadth, its enormous sort of expanse of longevity. It stretches for so long that it has almost obliterated memory for the victims as well as for the victimizers. African Americans don't have clue about what their history was
Right. Before
the North Atlantic slave trade, when Africa in its antiquity produced these civilizations that were those from which Greek civilization was derived. Don't know anything about that, and perhaps that's the greater crime, the crime that has had such deep-reaching psychological consequences for African Americans, and so it has robbed us of a sense of worth, because without a sense of history and memory, you can't have a sense of worth in your own people. And so many African Americans have been given to believe over the long time of this crime that they are not worthy of seeking compensation in the same way that other groups have been worthy of seeking compensation, because we have allowed ourselves to be legitimized or validated by the majority group.
Mm-hmm.
That really has not wanted to hear it, not even to talk about it. And so America is a big lie in this respect, a big, enormous, hypocritical giant that tells other countries that they have to come to terms with their past, but we have no inclination to practice this kind of honesty with ourselves. I simply think that you have to do this one step at a time. When I wrote this book, I had no reason to expect the kind of response that it has gotten. It has gotten an enormous response, and particularly in the black community, and particularly from black professionals,
mm-hmm.
who had not heretofore embraced arguments like this, perhaps for fear that whatever they had accomplished in the American mainstream could be put at risk in embracing something that sounded at first blush radical to them. But that is changing. And so now we're getting blacks at Harvard University, like Charles Ogletree and the law staff there, pursuing this issue. Dorothy Height of the National Council of
National Council of Black Women, right.
Yes, all of these organizations now are on board, growing support in the Congressional Black Caucus.
Right.
Seeking redress and acknowledgement, something much larger than an apology for this. But the consolidation first has to occur in the community of the victims.
Okay.
And then we have to bring it forcefully to the country.
And perhaps then now I can ask you to talk about at least some of the ideas that have been offered as a way to do that in a very concrete manner.
Well, there's a very a comprehensive, thoughtful law review article published in the Boston College Law Review last summer called Many Billions Gone, written by Robert Wesley, a professor at Tulane Law School. He proposes, and I describe his proposal in the book, that a trust be created out of the federal revenues paid into, of course, by black and white Americans. And this trust would support programs that are largely educational and economic. We need to close this educational gap between blacks and whites. Some of the most important years in our developmental lives are from birth to four. We need an early intervention in the lives of those who've been devastated by pathologies in our urban areas to break this vicious cycle. We need to give these kids a chance to excel academically and to pay for it out of the federal till for generations until that kind of gap is closed. And we need to be thoughtful and imaginative and innovative about educational methodologies to be employed to cut into the cycle with respect to the black poor, those people who've been bottom stuck since the Emancipation Proclamation intergenerationally through the 20th century. And then we need to talk about massive infusions of resources for economic development in the black community. I'm not talking about jobs alone. I'm talking about wealth-building programs that can make the black community wealthy on a level with mainstream America. I am not talking about cash payouts to people. My sense is that that would be a mistake, that the money would recycle back into the wrong pockets very quickly. I'm not talking about these programs being available for people like myself. I think there would be a need-based eligibility. And people like myself, of course, would pay into the federal till to support these kinds of programs. But with the coming of integration, the complexity of the black community revealed itself. We were never monolithic. And in that community, we had some of us who were fortunate enough to be poised to go up and out and to take care, to take advantage of opportunities that affirmative action and integration presented to us. Others, of course, debilitated by slavery and all that followed it, became bottom stuck, mired in these kinds of pathologies of which I speak. It is that community on which we have to focus this kind of force of compensation to bring them up to the rest of American society. And I think we can, in this discussion that John Conyers hopes to engender with his legislation, marshal enough expertise to puzzle out how to do this and what it would cost over what period of time.
Hmm. But before doing that, then the other conversation has to take place, because if people don't believe that there has been an injustice that needs to be remedied, then there's no point in talking about...
I can't agree more.
Yeah.
And that needs to take place for both communities. You see, the black community, the black child, for whom the battle is over before they even reach school age, that child needs to know that he or she is not succeeding because there's anything wrong with them innately. He needs to know that whatever happened to them happened a long time ago. So this debate is good for that child. It's good for those who occupy 41% of the jail cells in this country, these young black men, whose life chances were virtually nil from the very beginning. It's good for mothers who can't seem to find their way out of poverty, locked into these kinds of troubled, painful lives. It's good for whites who need to know that this kind of poverty is not peculiar for racial reasons to any particular group of people. They need to know what happened too. And so it is always beneficial to revisit history.
You in the book you talk with just and understandable pride about your family and your children and the success that they have had, and you talked a little bit about yourself and your own success. What do you think made the difference personally for you and made it possible for you and your kids to be successful while some other folks have not?
Well, I can't take any credit for my own success. Somewhere in my family chain, some member of my family, not terribly too far this many years, the sunny side of slavery, defied odds. Something like that had to have happened. And so I know my family through pictures and history back to 1870 or so. There will always be circumstances where some people succeed against great odds, and where some people fail when everything goes in their favor. In my family tree, at some pivotal point in our evolution, some group of people succeeded against great odds, and they made everything possible for all of the rest of us who flowed from that. And so I had no opportunity virtually to fail. My mother and all her sisters had gone to college. My father went to college. My father was a force. In my home with my father, it would have been dangerous to fail. And so he had expectations, as did my mother. And we had simply to work to meet those expectations. And so not going to college, not excelling academically, those things were not choices in my home. That is not the case for so many people about whom I am concerned. The expectation runs the other way. And I think people generally live up to or down to expectation. And often that bar is set by society. I just had enough energy, enough commitment, enough wherewithal through my family to overcome any small expectation of society in the case of me and my siblings. And so what I've been able to do is not at all surprising, and hence my children have all done well. But this constitutes not a majority. And there's still a disproportionate, if you compare our community with the rest of America, a disproportionate number of African Americans who have not done well. And they have not done well for the very reasons I describe in this book, and there's government responsibility, and we've got to get at that. We've got to run this down and describe it back to ourselves so that we can take responsibility and address these problems systemically in our society.
That's Randall Robinson from an interview that we did on this program, Focus, and back then we called it Focus 580. The show was first broadcast in April of 2000, and we were talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks. This is Focus. I'm David Inge, and we are celebrating our 30th anniversary this year by digging into what I have been calling the Deep Archives. These are programs that were recorded but are not as part of our regular web archive, and there are shows that have not been heard in a very long time. We'll be doing it again in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, we're certainly interested in your comments on this show. We're trying to collect some thoughts. People maybe have some thoughts about the program, what we've been doing over these now 30 years, particular topics, particular guests you'd like to tell us about. We're trying to collect those comments, and we're putting them on our website. So if you'd like to tell us what you think, actually about anything, but specifically about this program, you can go to the website, and that is WILL, will.illinois.edu. Go to the Focus section, and right up at the top, there'll be a place that you can make your comments. If you would like, you can also go to the Will Talk site, the one that we use for email for the program. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. That's fine that you could do that. And then if you'd just like to send us a letter in the conventional way, you can write us at WILL. We are at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, and the zip is 61801.